Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay? Yes. Okay, great. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm Holly Barreto. I'm a member of the Adult Education Committee and the Refugee Resettlement Team. And we're delighted this morning to welcome the Hashimi family, our friends and neighbors here in Princeton and who previously lived in Afghanistan. And we're really, really glad that all of you are here today. I was sharing with our friends, this is probably three or four times as many people as usually come to adult ed, and we're really glad that you're here. We're gonna introduce each of the Hashimis in a moment, but I also want to introduce Bill Krieger to the panel. Bill serves as the coordinator for the Refugee Resettlement Team, and he's going to help us understand some of what the past year or so has been like from the perspective of the volunteers from NASA and from outside our church as well. Speaking of volunteers, this has really been a team effort. Could everyone in the audience who has helped in one way or another with welcoming the Hashimis please stand up to be recognized? Thank you so much for your work. So the Hashimis have been very gracious to join us here today, and we're very grateful to them, and we want to respect their privacy. We don't have any security concerns, but the Hashimis do have a large family and many friends, and if this event were to get a lot of public attention, they might have to spend the next week answering questions about what's a Presbyterian. So we're asking that no one take any photographs or make any posts to social media, please. And if there's any members of the press present, the session is to be considered off the record. So the Hashimis' story of leaving their life in Afghanistan and settling here is a really full and rich one. We're going to spend most of our time today having them speak, knowing that we might not be able to hear the entirety of their experience today. We hope to have time for a question or two at the end, and the family has been kind enough to be willing to stay here with us during coffee hour to answer individual questions as well. And I think with that, we're ready to get started. So we're going to start with you, Saeed Sharif. We'd like this for a day to be where your family feels welcome. Could you please start by briefly introducing everyone in your family?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. My name is Saeed Sharif Hashimi, the elder son of the family. This is my mom, Soraya Hashimi, and this is my brother, Saeed Naeem. He's in Mercer County College. And this is my sister, Sahila.
You can stand if you want, or just wait. Yeah.
My elder sister, Husna. Omra, she's in middle school. Rodrigo. And Asma. Yeah, she's in high school.
So I did notice that you introduced yourself and your brother using Saeed. Can you explain to us what that means? Is that what all the term that
it's
all
a, it's Afghan a, it's
means?
A title. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like from my grandfather, he was Saeed, and my dad, he's Saeed. And I am Saeed. Like, it's a title before the name.
Okay.
You can call me Sharif, like my middle name, mm-hmm. but Saeed is a title.
Okay. So it's not something that all Afghan men are called.
No,
it's something specific to your family.
Specific to our family, to the Hashimis.
Okay. So my next question is for Soraya, if you wouldn't mind passing the mic to Soraya. Soraya, you're the mom of this family. And we're wondering if you could tell us a little about your own history and about your family's life in Kabul. And remember to hold the mic right up to your mouth. Thank you.
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of the name of Allah. My name is Soraya Hashimi. And wife of two-star general in Afghanistan. And Kabul is a small city. Surrounded by mainly mountain and crowded city, and we live in the center of town, and it's called Makruyan. Built by Soviet Union, like 40 years ago, and we. Have a educated family, like my father was a military captain, Air Force captain, and also my brother, like one brother professor and three brother pilot in the Afghanistan, like a private commercial airline. And we lived in near my mother's house in the same building, and it's life in Afghanistan, yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit more? I know you have family members who live in other parts of the world as well. Can give us a sense of that?
Yeah. My brother, he went to Germany 2025, the first Taliban captured Afghanistan. He went to Germany and he lives there. Mm-hmm. And my sister and the biggest brother live in Turkey. Yeah, mm-hmm. Since 6-7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I moved here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So previously, when you lived in Afghanistan, your family had experience traveling to other parts of the world as well.
Yeah, we travel a lot of time: Dubai, India, and Europe with my husband. Mm-hmm. And my husband visit two times in U.S., United States of America. Officially, and the first time he went, he was travel in 2007, and the second time he traveled to 2014, and back to home mm-hmm. country. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Saraya, you mentioned your husband, and your husband Saeed Ahmad isn't here. Can you please tell us a little more about him and his career and why he's separated from your family right now?
Yeah. My husband, Saeed Ahmad Nasir Hashimi, he's served like 20 years his life in the government in Afghanistan. He was two star general in Ministry of Interior, chief of staff, director of passport in Afghanistan, and he issued the computer passport, electronic passport, first time in Afghanistan, and when he retired in 2017. He worked with American forces, contractor, and that and the date when and the time when Afghanistan captured by Taliban. He wasn't in Afghanistan. He went to Dubai for reserve the COVID-19 vaccination, because in Afghanistan not the standard vaccination. And he think about the sometime we travel to foreign country, we need the vaccination card. And there was last August, the 7th of the 5th of August, he traveled to Dubai, and he was in Dubai to the men took over Afghanistan by Taliban, and after 1 week he decided to we left our country. We are left, yeah. We are leaving our country, yeah.
So I think, Saeed Sharif, this would be a great time for you to tell us a little more about your departure from Kabul. Could you tell us about August of 2021 for your family and what it was like for you all and for your neighbors?
Sure. So I will tell not exactly the date. I will tell from 12th of August, when all the evacuation process started. And first they started evacuation process from VIP people, from the embassies and all the VIPs. The airport route was my route when I was going to, there was a course, I was going to course, and the airport route was my route. I was going twice a day. And in 12th and 13th and 14th August, this road was like blocked by traffic, and all these armored Land Cruiser cars were all rushing to the airport. And no one knows what will happen. And the news are coming like north of Afghanistan is fallen, and the west side was fall, and the government's collapsed there. And lots of people left their house from the north of Afghanistan and came to Kabul because the only safe place in Afghanistan was Kabul, which was the capital. And everyone came to Kabul. And on that Friday, the 13th, we, my friends and we decided to help those people who left their house from north of Afghanistan and came to capital, and they were living in a mosque and in the grass, and all the families were like sitting in the grass, and we just bring them like food, blankets, water and stuff. And the Saturday, which was 14th, I was just passing by the airport, and there was a few people, like the count of hundreds, they were moving around the airport and looking. So we don't know what will happen and what's happening. What are the people doing in around the airport?
Were they Americans or were they
Afghan people? Yeah, Afghan people. Yeah, walking around the airport. On 15th, the day Taliban take over Afghanistan, it was around 11 o'clock. They say, "Oh, Taliban," because Taliban before taking over, they said, "We are not going to come to Kabul. We are just surround the Kabul and make a peace contract with the government and take over, like with officially, like with sign a contract and make a deal." But it didn't happen. Around 11 o'clock, the people said, "Oh, Taliban take over this district." Our home was in 9th district, and they were like in social media. We say, "Oh, Taliban take over 10th district, 11th district, like 9th district or something."
So you're following it on social media.
Yeah.
What's happening?
Yeah, what's happening? And they were posting like, "We took over this. We took over this. We took over this," and the stress becoming more and more. And you say, they were coming to the door. And after, like, around 2 or 3 o'clock, I saw a post from a politics in Afghanistan, which is a competition with Dr. Ghani, president of Afghanistan, Abdullah. He posted, like, "Today, Ashraf Ghani, president, left the country, and Taliban take over the country. And everything's down." So and he said that I'm at my home. He said, "Okay, he's home and everything is safe." And previous, the ex-president also posted, "Everything is fine. I'm at my home and nothing will happen." We said, "Okay." So the ex-president is here, and the other competitive of the president is here. So everything should be fine. And around 6 o'clock. We had, my mom didn't mention that we had security guards in front of our house. On the day, we told them that don't wear your military uniform, just be in casual clothes and walk around, what happens.
Can I ask why didn't you want them in uniform that day?
Because we know that most of parts of Afghanistan were collapsed, and if they come in, suddenly see you in uniform, so they will think like, oh, here.
It would attract attention yeah. to your family.
And they were looking at us like an enemy. So after that, we told them that, so the security guard came and said, oh, I saw Taliban moving around like the street, the market where we doing our shopping, like Princeton Shopping Center, it's near. And they said that the Taliban, we saw them, they're in this market, in the shopping center. We said, okay, that's good. And after that, we contact our dad that government collapse and Taliban take over the Afghanistan, and all the prisoners were released, and it's danger here, what will happen? He said, okay, I'll do something. So we were waiting, and we just started a little bit packing up, and it took us like a week, and on the 22nd, my dad called and he said, like, it was around 3 o'clock, he said, you have half an hour, go to the airport. Yeah.
Half an hour.
Half an hour.
Half an hour. Okay.
We said, okay, where we should go? He said, there's a gate that, there was, I think, 4 gates, which was, 5 gates, yeah. 3 gates were with U.S., U.S. Army, and one gate was with Taliban, and one gate was with British military. And I think my dad found a contact in British gate that they will. He gave them our names, and he said, "These people are coming." So. We went to that gate around 6 o'clock. Like, we reached to that gate around 6 o'clock because there was a crowd of thousands of people.
Yeah, was the road? I know you had talked about the road had to the airport was totally full. Was that
it was
still the same? You had to make your way through all of that to get to the airport.
Yeah, we got to the airport like a few miles away from the airport because there was no way for the cars to go, and we just walked. And the crowd, so slowly the crowd and the moved us to the gate. And when we reached to the gate, we waited like for 3 hours or something. And then the gate opened, and we were the second family because there was another family who passed the gate. And before us, one family passed the gate, and the second family was us, and we passed the gate and went to the airport. So in the airport, we were waiting for the people, because we are now in British side, and waiting for someone to come and bring us to the U.S. side, because the planes were departing, and the airport and the ramp and runway was with the U.S. government. So we waited for 4 days in the airport. Yeah, for just waiting for someone to come and bring us to the airway, because the runway and everything is locked. And I think that date was the days where people was rushing to the airport, and all people were running around the airway and the runway, and the airplanes couldn't take off or land. So on 26th, a guy called me, like, he said, okay, you were my dad gave him my number, and he said he called me and said, okay, take a picture of around your area, where are you, and I'll come and get you. I said, okay. And there was an ATM machine. I took the picture of ATM machine. I said, we are with this ATM machine, come here. Yeah. And he came, and we sat in the car and went to the runway where the flights are taking off. So in this period from the camp to the runway, there was a sewer way that all the people, if you saw the documentary of HBO, they showed the sewer way, which people were coming from Taliban store, and there was a sewer system or something, and they were passing this sewer system and then going to runway and airport.
So they were getting into the airport through the sewers?
Through the sewers, yeah.
Hello, my name is Saidneem Hashimi. The gate is actually called Abbey Gate. Mm-hmm. If you guys want to see the real documentary about this, it's called Escape from Kabul by HBO, and it's a real story. They have videoed it by the cameras soldiers had by their badges right here. And the gate is called Abbey Gate. It's not a sewer system. It's actually it's just a what do you call it? A small dam type mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. So people have to go into the water, and then the other side, the soldiers are standing. They would pull them out of the water, and you have to go into the water. Showing your ID, your documents, what do you have? Because mm-hmm. a lot of people are there. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. said we are only evacuating at-risk Afghans, and the special immigrant visas and the VIPs. So there were a lot of people, and they felt bad for the people because a lot of people, kids and everyone, but they had to take they had their priorities, and they had to take all everyone. And I could name a few ministers and parliament people. One minister is actually in the documentary. They, because the government collapsed, they had no power. They had to go through those ways, and some of the ministers actually came through those ways. So that was the way. We came to the airport on the 26th, and we... when we came to the airport and we were ready to be evacuated, that's when the bombing happened at the same door that we just passed through a couple of hours ago. Mm. Yeah, and my brother forgot to mention, when we were entering the airport, we actually went to the wrong door first. Mm. To the wrong door where the Taliban was there. Wow. And if you see the documentary, at that moment, the U.S. soldiers and the Taliban were together, not in a literal sense, but they were working together because the Taliban were covering the outside the airport, because each door had about 50,000 people waiting, each door, four doors. And so the Taliban were on the outside and the U.S. soldiers were on the inside. Mm-hmm. We actually went to the wrong door. My mom, sisters, and two of our guards to help us get through. Because before going to the airport, we knew what was happening in the airport. We saw the videos of people falling down the planes, mm-hmm. walls. We knew everything, so we were prepared. But when we entered the crowd, we were at the wrong door. But my mom said, she's right here. She said, we have to enter. And there was a crowd of like 6,000 people. And my mom said, after this door, your dad has contacted someone. Someone will get us. And we were like, okay. And the tough part was losing all these four ladies you see right here. I was holding her hand. Sharif was holding her hand, and my mom was holding Sohaila's hand, and one of our guards was holding Hosna's hand, so we don't lose the grip, because 6,000 people were dying because they get ran over. It was hot. We had bags, and at that moment when we entered, like, we passed like 3,000 people. It was tough. The grip, her hand, it was sweating, and I was really, that was one of the worst nightmares I had, losing her hand, because I almost left my bag because I didn't want to lose her hand. And then when we reached the door, actually the Taliban were shooting. I mentioned this to you and Tom. He's here somewhere. Yeah. Tom Charles. I mentioned that to Tom, that because there were so many people and you cannot stop them, they were shooting, actually. They were shooting to stop the people, and so the people retreat. And we were scared. But we passed that door and we realized we are in the wrong door. We did this 1 hour of hassle, 2 hours of hassle for nothing. This was the wrong door, and we had to leave and go to the other door, like my brother mentioned. And the other door, there was not a lot of crowd, but we still waited from like 8 o'clock to like 12 in the night, midnight, and then we entered the airport.
So you were in the airport. You had to wait for 4 days.
Four days
in the airport.
Yes.
Then you finally got on the plane.
Yeah, there was my dad found someone in the U.S. Military. I would never forget that person. He's called Happy. His name is Happy. He made us happy, and we spent 4 days in the airport, desperate. And we were losing hope because the people were saying that these are the last days, and if we are left in the airport, the Taliban is taking over the airport and everyone is getting killed. So that was a nightmare, but that was the last day, and we were in the UK side, and the UK soldiers were actually leaving that day. And when my dad found that person called Happy, He's actually from New Jersey, and now that great person is helping Ukrainian people to evacuate from Ukraine. Mm. So shout out to Happy.
Yeah. So Happy gets you to the place where you can get.
Yes, that was the contact my dad found, and he came in a car. I think we have photos as well, but he came in a car. He picked us up. We went to the U.S. side, and actually there was a line, a whole line, like I think 1 or 2 miles. That line was so long, line of people. But he just passed everyone. Thanks to him, he just passed everyone, and we just went to the planes, and we waited about 1 hour. After 1 hour, the explosion happened, and the alarms went off, and we went to a warehouse. We waited about 1 hour in the warehouse. After 1 hour, we got onto the airplanes and stuff. And Qatar, it was a 4-hour flight to Qatar. Then we had to wait 4 hours in the plane, C-17, 600 people just sitting. After that, we were getting processed in the U.S. military base in Doha.
Did you know where you were going to be going?
No. Okay. No one had any idea. Some people were saying, oh, they're going to take us to Germany. Or some people were saying Uganda. Yeah. And some people were saying, no, they're actually taking us to Washington. So we waited 3 days in Qatar, and then after that, they were checking the documents. What do you have after that? and we had passports and everything. If you didn't have the passport, it wasn't like if you, the people who made it to Doha, even if they didn't have nothing, like they would give them a paper, like just with the name, the date of birth and everything. We had passports and we had everything, so they just got our biometrics, and because it was tough for the U.S. military as well, because as my brother mentioned, the prisoners got released, 6,000 of them. The Taliban were there, and you wouldn't know who came into the plane actually, because they were processing people to get into the airport, but it was tough holding back 300,000 people. Someone would slip away, you know, so they had to do the biometrics, and actually a few prisoners made it to Doha and they had to send them back. And they, because the U.S. military had the biometrics of prisoners, and then we made, after that, after 3 days waiting in Doha, we made it to Washington, D.C.
And then what happened from there? Where did you, how long were you in D.C., and then where did you go?
About like six hours. Then we were sent to a camp in El Paso, Texas.
Okay. So you did not come right to New Jersey. You were then in the camp
in
El Paso.
In camp.
And how long were you all in the camp in El Paso, and what was that experience like?
3 months. We were in a camp in El Paso. 3.5 months. We were told that we'll be here for 15 days when we first arrived in El Paso, and they said that we would just process you, and we would just resettle you wherever you want. We had to choose. So, but then that was not the case, because when we entered the camp, there were 3,000 people, and in about 3 days, there were 12,000 people.
Wow. And what was your living situation like in the camp?
Oh, we were living in tents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Small tents, the size of this room. Mm-hmm. About 100 people. 75 people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 75 people. We had partitions, like a curtain, to separate families, you know, so yeah. 75 people. It was
so no privacy. I know, Soraya, you mentioned to me the other day you could hear everyone's babies crying. Yeah.
And no beds. It was the cots.
Yeah,
there were cots. Yeah, and the bags we had, we were misinformed. We were very misinformed. My dad said that it would be easy, and we had half an hour, like my brother mentioned, but our bags were left in Doha. We didn't have no clothes. With the clothes we came, and the soldier said that you can actually get clothes in the store, or you can stand in a line, and by knowing the history of Afghans, they had a line at the airport and a line at the store. Mm-hmm. So the free store for clothes, there were like 3,000 people waiting.
Yeah. Did you all have access to money at this time? Could you go and purchase
clothes? Yes. Fortunately for my mom and Sharif, was working at the time in Afghanistan, and he had his credit card, debit card.
Okay.
We didn't know if it would work, but even though the banks were closed in Afghanistan,
your debit card still worked.
That really helped.
That's great. You use the debit card.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm going to ask now is, Bill, if you can share a little bit with us. We have the Hashimi family waiting in El Paso, not knowing what's going to happen. Can you share with us what was happening here in Princeton as they were waiting? And how did the process of us getting matched, our church getting matched with the Hashimi family work?
Well, it wasn't nearly as tough as for us as it was for you. So First of all, we have a long history of working with refugees, and Tom Charles, Sue Jennings, Lauren Valvanis sprang into action and started assembling a team, and they're really the heart and soul of this whole effort. They put in countless hours. If you ever get a phone call from Tom Charles, just say yes. It'll save time. You know, started assembling a team. The very first crucial thing, we could not have a family welcomed here if we hadn't had housing, and that's the hardest part. We didn't just need affordable housing in Princeton. We needed very affordable housing in Princeton, and that was tough. So Tom worked with John Gilmore and the Princeton Theological Seminary to arrange housing. It was a long process. In the end, they were extremely generous. They didn't give the house, they're renting it to the Hashimis, but you know, at a lower than market rate, and it's a very large house. Meanwhile, Marsha Wood sprang into action and started assembling furniture for the house. Kate Torrey, Christina Hill started doing housewares. Thank you. I'm always hoarse. Kate Torrey, Christina Hill started doing housewares and clothing. Holly, you were starting to worry about food, all of that. You know, in the end, we waited till much later. But it was a big effort to get ready. Meanwhile, we were working with Church World Service, which was the agency that the government had contracted to help settle people. And if you remember, there hadn't been very many refugees to America in recent years. And so Church World Service had let go much of their staff. And meanwhile, we're having a COVID epidemic. So it was hard to know who to talk to there, and the people that we talked to were new. And we weren't getting many answers from the government. So it was a bit of frustration. We actually had the house ready by mid-October, I think. But then we had to wait and wait and wait. And we didn't know about the Hashimis. We thought any family that we got would be coming from New Jersey. Eventually, because we had a big house, Church World Service identified them as being a good match to us. And I'll stop there and hand it back to you. Okay.
So we got matched with them. And then your family left El Paso and you came to New Jersey. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, about what that process was like then coming here and your first days here?
Okay, so from Texas, from New Mexico, we fly to Atlanta, and then connection flight to New Jersey to Newark. So we first came to Newark. They gave us bags with the a sign on it. Like I don't remember the sign. Yeah, IOM sign. IOM. I think it's a immigration or agency, something. So we had that sign in our bag, and they said, when you have this bag with you, someone will come and tell you to, like, bring you with them, and you will go to housing or something. We said, okay. We came to the airport. We have this bag, and there is numbers in that bag. We waited for 1 hour, and no one showed up. So, and we don't have a SIM card or something to contact, and there is a few numbers in the bag. And the interesting part is I figured out, and I said, okay, let's call one of these numbers. And I asked a personnel in the airport that, can you call this number? And they called it. And the guy picked up the phone, and he says, okay, I was working 7 years ago for IOM, and I left my job. And his number is in the bag.
Yeah. So how did you get connected then? How did you leave the airport?
So we were just waiting. And finally, a guy came in and he said, oh, okay, I got car for you. And they took us in the car, and we went to... So when we were coming out from the airport... So it's the first time we're out in, like, in public in the United States, because we stayed 3.5 months in a camp, not in open public place. Mm-hmm. So when we walked out the airport, a guy is standing and his pants slipped off, and he's a drug addict, like, drug addict, and he's coming like probably he wants food or something, so he's coming toward us, and my sisters are scared like, oh, what's that? And the guy said, oh, okay, that was your first impression of the United States. So we got in the car and drove to the house, and we stayed on that house for 15 days.
So that was in Jersey City, right?
Jersey City, yeah.
So you were in another place.
Yeah, and it was, I think it was Airbnb house, mm-hmm. And church will service paid everything. Mm-hmm. And after 15 days, I think we did interview with Mr. Tom, and after that interview, he said, okay, we have housing and everything for you. So then we came to Princeton.
Yeah. Can, we only have about maybe 10 minutes total left. So I would love in this last couple minutes before we open it up to some audience questions, if you all could just tell us a little bit about your time in Princeton, maybe particularly those first couple, that first time here. What were the biggest challenges here? What were the biggest worries? What did you do for money? What was going well? You know, whatever you want to share with us about the first experiences in Princeton.
The house we had in Jersey City was decent, was a good house, but we didn't know we would get such a big house, thanks to Tom Charles, Bill Krieger, everyone from the church, and yeah, so we were really happy for the house. And as my mom mentioned, thanks to my dad and my mom, we compared to other Afghans who are here in the United States who were evacuated, we were well off, but we had never experienced something like this before. So we were happy to be here at the house, and the first days were really good because my mom was happy, and we had left the camp because the temperature in the camp, the ACs were now working really good. I had, because even the Afghans, I knew a little bit of English when I was in the camp, and all the Afghans didn't know English, so they would call me, and everyone would say like, "Oh, can you talk to the soldier so they could fix the AC?" And I was the AC guy. I had to talk to the soldiers about the AC and the cooler and how the heater works and stuff. So yeah, when we came here, that was a big privilege. Yeah. And then the housing, thanks to you guys, they gave my brother a car, and he got his license. My mom was going shopping, and everything was coming back together, which was really good. And my mom was actually studying thanks to the volunteer teachers we had, Beverly, Nancy, Barbara, and a few more teachers. She was happy because she was learning English, ESL. And yeah, my sisters were getting into school. They were really happy, and that is it.
So I think an important piece that we talked about at the beginning is that your husband Soraya still is not here with us. And I'm wondering if, Bill, if you can explain a little bit about the family's current legal status and immigration issues that the church is working to support them on.
Sure. So the Hashimis are here under the humanitarian parolee program, which means they can stay for 2 years. And they're in the process of applying for asylum, which would be permanent status here and eventually citizenship. It takes a long time, and it's a long and frustrating process. They've been working with a lawyer that the church is helping to identify and then paying part of the costs for. General Hashimi is also applying for admission to the United States under the same parolee program. He's also applying for a special immigrant visa. it's a long and frustrating process. We're pretty sure that in the end it will all work out happily. No, there's no guarantees, but it's frustrating. So they've been very diligent and very tenacious in getting through this process.
Something that was interesting to me to learn is that he's not able to be here with you because he wasn't with you when you evacuated. And so that's sort of a quirk in the legal process that's causing that continued separation.
Okay. Exactly.
I think at this time we have time for maybe a question or two. I'm going to grab the mic that's working. Actually, Bill, would you mind doing that? You can be our mic guy. And just wait for Bill to kind of have the mic passed to you. Please hold it right up in front of your mouth and speak clearly so everybody can hear you.
Is it possible to ask your sisters a question? I would like to ask you, how do you feel you were in Afghanistan where girls are so restricted? How does it feel to be here, and what are your experiences?
Who wants to say something?
Hi. So, as I think, if being in Afghanistan as a girl, so we must be in home and we should leave our school. But it's different in here is we can learn more, we can go to school and we can continue our education. So maybe it's a little bit hard from there in here. Like in here it's easy to go to school and we are not very restricted. But in there, it's anything is closed, and they are stopping education for ladies and girls. So, yeah, it's good being in here, but it's also tough for the people in Afghanistan. Yeah.
We have time for one or two more questions. Anyone else?
I just wonder if you're in touch with family and friends in Kabul and how they're doing.
Thank you. We call once a week. My mom, my mother, she's in Kabul, and she's a old woman. All the time she worry about me, and because I'm living in the same building with her, and sometimes, and my husband every day, and he contact us and asking about your life and how you need it and how is the girl doing, and how is the boy, and he call, and we call my sibling, my sister, brother in Afghanistan and foreign country, and it's good. We are available to talk with them here. Yeah.
Is your family who's still in Afghanistan, are they safe? Are they, you know, what is their situation?
My two sisters worked in Ministry of Education, and now they doesn't go to work and they stay at home and they don't allow to go to work. And the another family, which one is the military, like my brother-in-law, that stay at home, but my brother... he's a doctor, one brother, and two is a pilot in commercial airline. They work it they go to job and work. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more question.
What do you miss most about Afghanistan?
I think it would be my country
itself and the family and the memories we have there. That stuff. That's never, because I was born there, every one of us. And my childhood and everything we spent there. And those memories are very dear to my heart. And yeah, that's what I would miss, I think. Yeah.
I think that is a great place for us to wrap up today. The Hashimis, as I said, are going to stay for a coffee hour and have agreed to be available during that time for individual questions. Soraya, Syed Sharif, Syed Naeem, Sohaila, Husna, Omra, and Asma, thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you. I also want to encourage you to come back next Sunday as our series Hearing from All Corners of Our Community continues with Farzijana Adeneye Risikota, a visiting scholar at the Overseas Ministry Study Center, who's going to be sharing with us about God's call to Christians in Indonesia.
And can I just jump in terms of if anybody's wanting to volunteer, talk to me and we'll find something for you to do either with the Hashimis or with a future family. We also need a laptop. One of the laptops that the family has been using just broke. If you have one that's in good condition, we need that donated. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.